This time, it's an honor to reintroduce to you Dr. Dallas Willard. What I appreciate about this man is having watched the effect of his work, his books, on students, and to realize that a student that has been falling behind and needs to read this book overnight is not going to be able to do it in an overnighter, because there's, as you know, there is so much substance to this. And in a day of the fast sell and the popular media, it is wonderful to have a man who speaks to both the head and the heart, and who understands the world of academics and understands the world out there. And so please join me in welcoming Dallas Willard.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and to be a part of this, and I'm so encouraged to know that there is an institution here that is standing up for Christian thought. There's nothing that the world needs more now than some Christian thought, and we should at least let our thinking keep up with our talking and make sure that we know what we're talking about, and it's just wonderful to be here. And so I'm thankful also for Ruth and for Roger and what they stand for. And actually, I think I want to start out just by saying that you see in them a beautiful illustration of what it is to know what good and evil are, and to be on the side of good, and to be able to stand through the years and just let that move forth from them. I want to talk to you in my time this morning, as you'll see from your bulletin, about the disappearance of moral knowledge. And see, we are in a time when the world generally can look at someone such as Roger or Ruth and say, well, that's odd. Wonder what happened that they're like that, but not understand that they're like that because they know something. They know something. Two days after September 11th of last year, I had a man call me from a newspaper in Southern California, and he asked me a question. And the question was, what is evil? Now, you have to stop a moment and let yourself dwell on that. He's calling me. I suppose someone thought I was an expert. Because now, we exist in a world of experts. And I was an expert on evil. So you call up the professor and say, what is evil? And so we have to stop and ask ourselves, what kind of a world is it in which people would ask the question, what is evil? We have to ask questions like, where did they go to school? What kind didn't they tell them in school? It's shocking to go back to an old Chuck Berry song, "Hail, All Hail Rock and Roll," up in the morning and off to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. That was a rock song. And it was a record of what actually happened. But of course, you can't do that now, because that would violate separation of church and state. See, we can be thankful that God didn't give Moses the multiplication tables, can't we? Because then we wouldn't be able to teach them in our public schools. I'm sure he was looking ahead and had us in mind. You see, we're in a very sad circumstance where, frankly, moral knowledge has disappeared. Now, it hasn't ceased to exist. Please understand that. And it serves as an absolute bedrock foundation for the life of the person who not only hears about it, but really does know it. It hasn't ceased to exist, but it has disappeared as a resource that is available to the public. It's disappeared. Now, what I'm saying to you is not something that's a secret. It's something that's widely known, and those of you who are here as leaders might like to look at a book by Julie Rubin. And Julie Rubin is associate professor at Harvard University Graduate School of Education. She's written a book called The Making of the Modern University. And that book is primarily a story about how moral knowledge disappeared from the university curriculum. And it's a very penetrating analysis. I really encourage you to study that. I won't have time really to go very deeply this morning. And I apologize for that. I'd like to be inspirational if I could, but today I want to really cover some concepts that are so fundamental to our whole discussion. And anyway, philosophers are supposed to go down deeper and stay down longer and come up drier than anyone else. So if you find yourself nodding off, pinch the person next to you, and they'll slap you and that'll wake you up. So let's just begin with this thought. Human life depends on the capacity to distinguish between good and evil. The things that Richard spoke so eloquently of that come to us from a liberal education are good. And to pursue them is to believe that there is a difference between good and evil, and that we can identify. A knowledge of good and evil is different from feeling. We're very big on feeling now. We even have a song, Feeling, whoa, 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 feeling. Do you know that song? Yeah. And we allow that people have feelings. But feelings are very different from knowledge. And you are really in trouble if you base your life on feeling. Because feeling will not guide you to reality. So let me begin by just saying, what is knowledge? I find that I actually have to do this now in my courses, because no one has ever told my students what knowledge is. And we have still on our buildings statements about truth and what a wonderful thing it is. But most people could not tell you what truth is. And most of my students don't believe in it. And their teachers don't believe in it. Truth is in real trouble today. Knowledge, and I'll say this slowly, and some of the things I'll say, I'm afraid, will be a little cumbersome, but if you could just make a note or two on it, it might help us think it out. What is knowledge? Knowledge is our ability to represent things as they are. And represent could be either talk or think. But knowledge is our ability to represent things as they are on an appropriate basis of thought and experience. Knowledge is our capacity to represent things as they are. So that's truth, you see. Truth is essential to knowledge. Knowledge secures truth. And the important thing about truth is it enables us to integrate with reality. If you believe the chair you're sitting on is reliable, and it's not, and you sit on it, you will have an unfortunate encounter with reality. See, reality. You can define reality as what you run into when you're wrong. And truth guides you, and knowledge secures truth. So I just say again, knowledge is our ability to represent things as they are on an appropriate basis of thought and experience. See, it isn't a wild guess that happens to be right. You have to have that basis. Now then, when I say to my students introducing the course, why are we here? It will normally take them a long while to get around to knowledge. And eventually some person may sort of timidly and uneasily say, well, we want to know something. See, that's not easy to come to, since truth and even reality are in real trouble. And so the aim of the course is to have knowledge, not just to get credentialed. I often will joke with my students after they take a test and they're leaving, I'll say, did you believe what you wrote? And see, you don't have to believe it, you just have to get the right answer. But then they'll walk out of the room and they'll live in terms of their beliefs, and if their beliefs are false, they will not be able to deal with reality. I want to give you a passage from Isaiah 5, verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Isaiah 5:20. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink. Well, you see, those latter points naturally come out of confusing good and evil. And if you think it's good to be heroic in drinking wine and valiant in mixing strong drinks, that's what you'll do. See, those who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. You see, one way of reading that is to say, well, calling good evil and evil good is malicious. It is done out of bad intent. Undoubtedly, that is sometimes true. But generally speaking, when you see that happening, it is because knowledge of good and evil have disappeared. And people are no longer in possession of it. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in today. And a lot of this comes from the fact that we have defined knowledge wrongly. I say this especially to a Christian institution and people who are concerned to represent Christian teaching in this world. You see, the disadvantage that a Christian institution faces as an institution of learning is we have allowed the secular mind to define what knowledge is. Let's say that again. We have allowed the secular mind to define what knowledge is. And of course, they define it in such a way that knowledge of God and good is omitted. And that is why you've perhaps heard used the word naturalism. And naturalism is a term that really does mean that only what can be known by one of the sciences counts as knowledge, and only what corresponds to scientific knowledge is reality. And this has a lot of advantages for a world where the will is exalted as supreme. Because if you want to know what to do about right and wrong, that may limit your will. And if you want to follow your feelings, whoa, 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 feelings, then knowledge of good and evil is going to get in your way. And it will say to your feelings, no. It doesn't matter. And so the definition of knowledge in terms of what comes out of the pipe of one of the sciences, strangely enough, omits the most important things in human life. There's almost nothing that concerns you as a human being that you can answer on the basis of one of the sciences or more. Almost nothing. Now, that's not to say they're not important. They are. But they're only important in terms of a larger knowledge of good and evil. See, God has protected us through the centuries, through the millennia, from knowledge of how to manipulate reality, while He gives us a chance to grow in knowledge of what to do with it if we had it. And now when you go from here to Los Angeles, you'll stand in about 15 lines. While technology does its part to protect you from evil. It's so very important to understand what knowledge is and to understand why apparent but not real knowledge leads to destruction. Now, the fact that there is now no body of accepted moral knowledge is tied to the fact that religion has moved out of the area of knowledge. See, we want to remember that until very recently, it was assumed that there was a body of Christian knowledge. That Christian teaching was not just another tradition that happened along with all of the other traditions, but that it was a body of knowledge. And this was assumed in our country by its leaders well up into the middle of the 20th century. So that presidents and judges and others in leadership would standardly say, like President Truman or others, this is a Christian nation. Now, when they said that, they did not think simply, well, we have Christian traditions. Rather, they assumed that there was a body of Christian knowledge. A body of Christian knowledge, knowledge of reality. Remember what knowledge is now. It's the capacity to represent things as they are. And so when we sing these great hymns that we have sung, I love the one we started with last night, immortal, invisible, God only wise, in light inaccessible, hid from our eyes. Well, now, what are we doing there when we say that? Are we just feeling? Is that just feeling? Oh, these are wonderful feelings we get from thinking this. Are we pumping feeling? Unfortunately, that's about as far as many people can get. But the assumption up until pretty much the middle of the century among leaders was this represented knowledge. This is not emoting. It is stating what is true. There is a God like this, great Father of glory, pure Father of light. Thine angels adore thee, all veiling their sight. That's reality. Not something, it would be wonderful if it was true, and you will feel a lot better if you think it's true. And let's all get together and cheerlead for it. See, no, no. This is knowledge. You see, that was the assumption that, for example, the Apostles' Creed and the great creedal tradition expressed a body of Christian knowledge. And tied to this situation of the loss of moral knowledge is the accompanying loss of knowledge of God and the idea that there is such a thing as Christian knowledge. See, that went hand in hand with the disappearance of theology as a field of study in the university. And so theology disappears and religion takes its place. Well, religion is a human phenomenon. And you can properly study that by the methodologies of the social sciences. But what happened to theology? Well, you see, that switch happened because of the surrender of the idea that theology provides you with a body of knowledge. Am I making any sense to you at all? You understand what I'm saying? And you can go back and you can trace historically the disappearance of theology as a field of study in which you gain knowledge. And the American past is wonderfully rich in all of this. But as progressively knowledge becomes defined in terms that omit God and omit morality, then of course theology disappears. And it was interesting to watch how this happened in some Christian schools, because some hung on to it. But then, for example, problems of transferring credits made it desirable to drop theology. It's okay, you can transfer credits in religious studies. You see how that works? It's very important to think your way into that. And so we had a situation where basically our moral knowledge was based upon our theological tradition. And again, that was largely accepted. And we went through a period of trying to take moral knowledge off of its theological basis and set it on a secular basis. And that is the project that has not succeeded. Now, you know, I'm getting up here and talking about a lot of very deep stuff, and I don't have time to tell you all the things I don't mean by what I say. But we want to understand that the problem that was sensed and emphatically emphasized by people at the beginning of the 20th century about how can we dispense with our belief in God and keep our morality, that problem remains unsolved. It remains unsolved. I want to just now take you through a little of the history of ethical theory. Hang on. Because if you go back to the 1880s and the 1890s, and you look at what was taught and practiced at Harvard University or Yale or any of our leading universities and colleges, you will see that there was assumed a substantial body of moral knowledge that was an elaboration of the Judeo-Christian teaching. And the leading thinkers of this time, such as T.H. Green, and F.H. Bradley, and Henry Sidgwick, and others who, if you have studied moral theory, you may recognize those names. And they were very concerned and very busy taking moral teachings that had come down through the tradition and was accepted as knowledge, and placing them on a basis of the analysis of human personality. The idea was that the fundamental truths of the moral life could be reset on an understanding of the human self. And I want to tell you that literature is wonderful. And it even includes John Dewey in the days when he was a Sunday school teacher. And if you read that material, you will come away with a very good sense of right and wrong and good and bad. And it's all centered on the will to good. The will to good was the center of ethical thinking. See, now you can see, if you just think a moment, how that would fit in with the great teachings of love of neighbor as yourself, of love as the central command. And then trying to understand how that worked in a community and in a family and in a nation. The writings of T.H. Green and F.H. Bradley and others and Dewey of that period are wonderfully instructive. And that consensus of moral knowledge that served as a basis for thinking about law and about education, and about social work, which emerged soon after that, really out of Christian motives and understanding of what we ought to do, was wonderful in its content. Now, soon after that, an interesting thing happened in the universities. First of all, there came the need to divorce the university from the church. Those of you who are familiar with English history will remember the great controversy over the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church, which people to teach in the universities had to swear fealty to. And there was a great conflict over this, because they included not only the substance of the Christian teaching from the great creedal tradition, but they also included a lot of other things which, putting it mildly, were less central to the Christian faith. And so there was a progression there. It happened here in this country, the need to divorce the university and the professorate as a profession from the clerical setting. If you take George Marsden's book on the soul of the American university and just read the statistics on the number of, on the percentage of professors of not just religious schools, but secular schools who were ministers, you will be astounded. Because I think it was something like 42% of the presidents of the secular schools at the turn of the century were clergymen. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying, understand, that's how it is. And of course, today, they tend to be scientists, because that's where the authority has shifted. Now, we need to understand that process, because what it meant was that people who had the responsibility of understanding and teaching moral theory in our universities no longer regarded themselves as responsible for the good in their community. And that's a huge change. And so, in the work of G.E. Moore and others in the early part of the 1900s, you have people turning from the analysis of life and will to the analysis of concepts. So instead of discussing good in its human setting, you have very abstract discussions of good and goodness as a disembodied universal or a concept. And the aim of moral theory became not practice, but theoretical refinement. And as someone has said, if you know this language, we turn from beta ethics to meta ethics. And we have, instead of talking about the good and the right and what is to be done in human life, we talk about how we talk about that. Right? And that progression now continued to deepen through the 20th century. And very soon, the positivist came along, and you'll see a good bit of that story if you look at the Rubin book that I mentioned, because she goes into very good detail on how this progression affected education. Very soon, the positivists came along and said, well, you know, good doesn't mean anything. When I say something is good, I'm just saying hooray for it. Or if I say it's bad, I'm just saying boo. And so this became known as the boo hooray theory of ethics. And what was prominent there? Feeling. And feeling becomes the only content to ethical approval and disapproval. And some of you may know this is called emotivism in ethical theory. And there has been a reaction to that, and there's been a serious effort to try to pull ourselves out of that irrelevance to life. And especially when we had all the issues about the draft and segregation and the rights of various groups that became pressing in the 60s and in the 70s, there was a disinclination to say, well, it's just my feeling. No, there was an insistence that there's something right and something wrong. But to this point, ethical theory, for all of the efforts of outstanding thinkers such as Alistair MacIntyre, John Rawls, and others less known, you may know those names because they're so well known, we are still in a position where, according to our leading ethical theories, there is no knowledge of morality. None. Sometimes I have to tell my students that the reason why political correctness has become so important is because there's no other kind of correctness. And the reason why recourse to the legal system has become such a constant thing in our culture is because there's no moral basis upon which people can meet and determine what is right and wrong. And that's the situation, that's where we stand today. Now, I want to say a few words about morality and good, because I think that the answer to the question, what is good in morals, is a very obvious one, and I want to share that with you, at least for you to think about. And what is evil? I'd like to answer that question before I finish here today. Let's start with what is morality. Morality is a shared understanding with associated emotional postures, because morality does involve feeling, concerning which types of persons are to be or are not to be. I'll go slowly here because I'd really like to make it possible for you to get this down and think about it. It's a shared or public understanding with associated emotional postures concerning which types of persons are to be or not to be admired, approved, imitated, encouraged, and supported. As to which types of people are to be admired, approved, imitated, encouraged, and supported, without regard to whether they prosper or are enabled to accomplish what they desire, without regard to whether they prosper or are able to accomplish what they desire. It is not a sure sign of a good person that they get what they want. Now, see, most people understand this very clearly. And in teaching ethical theory, after we've discussed the theory known as egoism, I will ask my students, now many of you, I say, will want me to write letters of recommendation for you. Would you want me to say about you that you are a person who always strives to get what they want? I have yet to have a student say, yes, professor, I'd like you to say that about me in a letter of recommendation. Because we know that that's not the heart of being a good and reliable person. I want to just read that again, because these are the kinds of statements that people hate philosophers for. It's important to try to be accurate. And I plead with you to bear with me. Morality is a shared understanding with associate emotional postures concerning which types of persons are to be admired, approved, imitated, encouraged, and supported, without regard to whether they prosper or are able to get what they want. Now, what kind of person is that? Well, let me tell you now what kind of person that is. Here is the good person. The good person, the morally good person, is a person who is intent upon advancing, who is intent upon advancing the various goods of human life. The morally good person is a person who is intent upon advancing the various goods of human life with which they are effectively in contact. A good person is not necessarily someone who sits around dreaming about how to reform the world. So the morally good person is a person who is intent upon advancing the various goods of human life with which they are effectively in contact in a manner that respects their relative degree of importance, the relative degree of importance, and the extent to which the actions of that person can actually promote the existence and maintenance of those goods. Again, I ask your forgiveness. I don't know any way to make this simpler. I'll try to reword it a little bit. But a morally good person is a person who is intent upon advancing the various goods of human life with which they are effectively in contact, in a manner that respects their relative degree of importance and the extent to which the actions of that person can actually promote the existence and maintenance of those goods. That is the good person. The man who called me up to inquire what evil was, I told him, evil is the intent to harm. That's what evil is. Now, you wouldn't have to tell a 5-year-old child that. But after you've gone to college and perhaps taken an advanced degree and spent a lot of money, then you can ask questions like, what is evil? Because you have been through a system that has dulled your intuitions by theories that usually are completely out of touch with moral reality. I understand what a serious thing that is to say. I wish I had time to just read you a professional paper on that. Taking our leading thinkers and looking at, say, John Rawls' theory or Alistair MacIntyre's, these are good people. I'm not attacking them. Please understand. But when you read them and you back up, you ask, what in the world would ever make anyone say the things they're saying? And it is removal from the facts of moral life. And those are removed because they have accepted a model of knowledge that doesn't admit them into the arena. And that's why we have the disappearance of moral knowledge in our time. John Wesley, bless his heart, had a much simpler way of saying it. He said, do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as you ever can. I see Wesley caught the heart of the Christian message, which is the vision of moral good under God. And this is just what you do. Now, do you have to have training and education and experience to know how to do that? Yes, you do. Do you have to learn how to judge what are the goods that you can effectively implement and those that you can do very little about? Yes, you do. See, all of that should be in moral culture, but you have no place to start from unless you know what good is in the first place. Paul says, be not weary in well-doing, for when the time is right, you will reap the fruit, so don't give up. See, it requires great wisdom and moral culture, including grace, and this is required in order to do this and not turn it into something silly and legalistic. See, again, forgive me, Ruth and Roger, but you see, if you look at them, you see what this is about. They didn't turn it into something silly and legalistic. And the purposes of God in human life are defeated when people who mean to do well wind up acting like fools because they're trapped by some legalism, some failure to appreciate what is more important than other things, and wind up emphasizing majoring in minors and minoring in majors. So it requires a lot of wisdom. But you have to have the central insight before you can move in that direction. And see, that's why we have to understand that for the human condition, knowledge of God is fundamental. For knowing good and evil and living it out. It is not dispensable. And I want, above all, perhaps other questions to leave before you this issue. Is it really possible to lead a moral life of the quality intended by our nature apart from God? Now, we often get this question discussed. Can an atheist be good? Well, how good? Right? See, that's the question. Like, I will often have a student come to me and say, you know, I've met people here at the university that are more loving and gracious than the people in my church at home. Well, they haven't really begun to get down to the basic realities of what it means to live a life devoted to moral goodness. And they're mistaking the pleasantries of a life, especially where they don't feel any judgments are made. And they look back at their church people and they say, well, they made judgments. They said we're people are right and wrong. And these people I'm with here now, they're tolerant. They don't judge you. Now, there's a real point to that, and I don't want to miss that point. There is overjudgmentalness. Again, legalism, majoring on minors becomes such a burden in our churches, and it shouldn't be there. But the answer is not to simply back away and say, whatever, you know. That isn't love. Love is seen when you begin to see people who can genuinely sacrifice themselves for the good of others. Love begins to stand out then. Love defined. See, Jesus didn't leave us in a position of saying simply, love your neighbor as yourself. He said, love one another as I have loved you. He said, greater life, love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for others. And of course, the laying down of your life isn't just a matter of shedding your blood. Sometimes it's a matter of simply not being in a hurry. You see, it has to come down to the level of our bodies and our minds. And then morality begins to take over. Now, I want to emphasize that even though we talk as if there were no moral knowledge in the university situation, there is a morality. And it is painfully rigorous and rigorously enforced. And if you go contrary to it, you will experience it. And it often has things like, don't make judgments except this one. Tolerate everything except intolerance. Some of these intuitions still remain. One of the things you can count on young people to be morally disgusted with is hypocrisy, except in themselves. There's some things that hang on. A morality is taught, and it has to be taught because human life requires that instruction be given and people experience life in a way that their inward character is formed. We're not like quail and rabbits and dogs and things who just come into this world and sort of mature and that's that. We have to become who we are going to be, and that comes by learning and teaching. And so morality is constantly taught. And we have to understand that it is never taught as a personal preference. The morality that is taught on the campus, the secular morality, that expresses itself in things like that we call political correctness and so on. And I apologize for speaking so crudely about it, but I hope you understand what I mean. You see, that is never taught as a personal preference. You cannot teach a morality as a personal preference. It is never taught as a mere social practice or a style of some sort. It is always taught as how knowledgeable people deal with reality. And it cannot be taught in any other way, because morality is a matter of belief. And a belief is a matter of being ready to act as if something were so. And that always brings you up against what is really there. And what we have not found in the contemporary world is an adequate background of belief that enables us to support the highest moral ideals that we intuitively feel are right. That is the number one lack today. And you can think of it in terms of understanding human personality if you wish. And that's fine if you interpret it broadly enough. Psychology as a discipline should guide us in this. But unfortunately, psychology as a field has developed under the edicts of the secular mind. And that is why even to today, we really don't have a Christian psychology. We have Christian psychologists. But a Christian psychology would do justice to the nature of the human self that makes the unifying principle in human life love of God, worship of God. That's the only line that can hold the weight of love your neighbor as yourself. Is you have to be able to see your neighbor in a context of the kingdom of God and yourself in that context. So there is enough room that allows you to face, in reality, as Richard said, the tragic moments of life. You have to have a larger field of vision of the kingdom of God and who God is and what he's like before we can respond to what we all know that we should be and should do. And of course, in that knowledge, reach out and trust that kingdom and receive the grace of God for the moral fulfillment in our individual lives, in our vocations, and in our communities that was intended by God in making us like we are made. And that remains lacking. And so we have all these things about culture wars and so on. A culture war is a struggle between fellow citizens and groups over which morality will govern shared societal and government institutions, law, media, family life, schools, churches, businesses, labor, international relations. Which morality will govern the formulation and practice of those institutions? Well, I wanted to say just a little bit today in closing about what we can do about all of this. And I'll put it as simply as I can. The most important thing that we need to do is to understand what morality is and how it works. We need to understand what morality is and how it works. And most importantly, we need to understand that the people who profess not to be practicing a morality are practicing a morality. You cannot avoid it. See, it's often presented as if, well, you have a Christian morality, and then you have these other people who aren't practicing a morality. No, they're practicing a morality. We need to understand what a morality is and how it works. We need to understand how, for example, things like how a morality is taught. A morality is almost never taught by explicit teaching. It's taught by tones of voice, by gestures, by stories that are told, by responses to this situation and to that. That's how morality is taught. That's why, for example, we often find that in Christian homes, the morality that is actually learned by the children is not the one that is explicitly taught. It's the one that is taught by the tones of voice and the body language. It's taught by what is present in the body of the parents. It's taught by the stories they tell and the tones in which they tell them. And that's what the child learns, because that's how morality is taught. And every professor in a classroom teaches a morality by who they are and how they respond. Everyone does. And of course, that's the great illusion, is I don't teach morality. You can't live with people and not teach morality. So we need to understand that. And we especially need to understand that when we come giving the teachings of Christ about morality and people reject that, they are accepting a morality in that very rejection. And we need to say, how do you justify that morality that you accept? And not just say, well, we as Christians have the burden of justifying, but they don't have the burden of justifying. It's the same way with theology. As theology began to disappear, you had outstanding leaders, Christians, in education, like Noah Porter of Yale, who said, if you omit God from your teaching of sociology, you are teaching theology. You are teaching that the subject matter that you're dealing with has no relevance to God, and God has no relevance to it. That's theology. You're teaching something about God. You can't avoid it. If you present all of knowledge, as we do today, there isn't a single field of knowledge in which knowledge of God is thought to be a part of professional competence. That's what makes it so hard when a person goes to a PhD program at the University of Chicago or University of Minnesota or wherever university, and they get a PhD in their field, and they are taught that their knowledge is complete without a knowledge of God. See, I'm saying these things now, and you may think, how strange that you'd say that. But that's just because we're so used to it. And that's the challenge, as I said last night. I mean, for the Christian faculty, what's the difference? Is it just that they're nicer, or do they really know something that other people don't know? Well, if you know something as a Christian that other people don't know, you didn't get that in your PhD program at the University of Chicago. And one of the things that we have to do in responding to the situation of the disappearance of moral knowledge is for Christian institutions to take a stand with complete openness of mind, no dogmatism, no poo-pooing of difficulties, but hard intellectual work to deal with the issue of integrating knowledge with the knowledge of God. We look back upon the medieval period in which people said things like, theology is the queen of the sciences. Where is theology today in relationship to the sciences? Do we have the courage as Christians to raise the question? Or are we paralyzed with fear that if we raise that question, we'd be run out of our profession? See, those are real issues that we have to take a stand on. In our writing and speaking, we need appropriately to help others understand what is actually going on in this area of moral knowledge. We need to keep alive the issue which morality is best and address it straightforwardly and thoroughly. We need to stand on these issues. Again, completely open. All that religion requires of thought is a fair field and no quarter given. It doesn't require that we not ask certain questions. It says we can ask any question. It became clear to me many years ago in graduate school that if I could find a better way, honestly, Jesus would be the first person to tell me to take it. You can't imagine him sort of standing there and saying, well, that's better, but you know, it's not Christian. You know, and if you can't imagine him saying that, I'll guarantee you, you will have a hard time trusting him. You have to understand that complete openness, unabashedly, intelligently, presenting Jesus Christ as the only source of an adequate morality, and challenge the world that confronts you fully, openly, thoroughly, on the best knowledge, the best understanding, that has to be developed. Where's it going to be developed, if not in a place like this, by people like you? How is divinity or theology going to be recovered as a field of knowledge if you and I don't do it? How are we going to do it if we as institutional people don't say this is our objective? We are going to rehabilitate theology, morality, as a field of knowledge. Now remember what knowledge is, the capacity to represent things as they are on an adequate basis of thought and experience. We need to know and clearly articulate the difference as to what is good evidence and what is not, what is a good question and what is not, how questions are answered. And we need, above all, not to accept second place in our work as Christians in education to anyone else. And there has been, in many quarters, a tacit acceptance of the idea that we should accept second place, that we're playing a defensive role, not a role of honest and open inquiry, finding out truth and presenting it to the world. When we think about the disappearance of moral knowledge, what we have to think about is the purpose of our institutions. I serve on what is called WASC, Western Association of Schools and Colleges. It's the accrediting association on the West Coast. And Standard 1A on that is a wonderful statement. And this is not a statement of Christians. This is a statement hammered out in long years of struggle, because the accrediting association there has had to work through this. What in the world are we about? Here's Standard 1A. An institution of higher education is by definition dedicated to the search for truth and its dissemination. As a consequence, faculty, students, administrators, trustees, and staff are committed to and supported in the free pursuit of knowledge and the expression of ideas. That's where we stand, the free pursuit of truth. And we cannot allow secular definitions of knowledge that are designed to eliminate knowledge of human personality, especially in its moral dimensions, and a knowledge of God in relationship to the world and all of the fields of study that we're in. We cannot allow that definition to isolate us and hamstring our efforts to lead in the pursuit of truth. As followers of Jesus Christ, we don't have a choice. We have to go the way of following him who is the Lord of truth and who said, if you continue in my word, then you are my disciples indeed, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. That's the whole story. On the elevator in our humanities building, it just says, the truth will set you free. Apparently today you don't even have to know it. But it only works when you follow him who is the Lord of truth. Thank you very much.